Ladies and gentlemen, it is the Cast Derbers podcast with a gay. I'm Christian Corley. This is James McLean, whose voice you may recognise.
If he doth speak.
If indeed he does speak. And we are here to talk about the Ghost Monument. Before we do that, a couple of things we need to talk about briefly. I've just remembered that I did tell a certain editor of the Doctor Who Companion that I would mention something on his behalf. And that is completely lost the link now. So we'll come back to that later on. It's something to do with scarves. Anyway. We are available on iTunes and what's the other one? Spotify as well. We're also on Spotify and a couple of other places. So you can listen to us anywhere and you can share us with anyone via Facebook or Twitter. And we're on Audiobeam, of course, as you may have heard earlier on. So, The Ghost Monument, episode 2 of Doctor Who series 11, again written by Chris Chibnall and with the supporting cast of Bradley Walsh, Tosin Cole and Mandip Gill joining Jodie Whittaker in floating in space in the opening moments. I tell you what, I'm not entirely, still not sold on the theme tune, but I am preferring the opening titles now.
You like the opening titles?
Yes, I do. They're reminding me of the Cushing films.
Okay, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. With the colour and the pulsing.
Yes. Yes, so I suppose it's a mixture of all things retro, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's a very 60s, 60s tone.
Yeah. So what where are you on those then?
Yeah, I quite like it. I mean, I think the new theme tune works. I must admit, I got quite used to Murray Gold's sort of opening section that he sort of added to the theme tune. But
yeah.
I, as we both said, never liked the last opening at all. The Capaldi one was the worst one I've heard out of any era, I think, possibly.
Well, we probably shouldn't give Murray Gold too much credit for it, because it's not too dissimilar to what appears in the TV movie 22 years ago, is it, that opening bit that he... added
to some degree, yeah. It's not just the visuals, it's the audio is just very, yeah, very jarring. Well, this sort of is a little better. No, I have no issues with it. It's very old school. Maybe a little too old school for me, but I think the fact that it seems to be, because the whole point of an opening sequence to some degree is to sort of give you some information about how you should be feeling. And that could just even simply just be about sort of getting you into understanding what genre you're about to be going into. Do you know what I mean? It's to give you that sort of, it's meant to prepare you for what that show is trying to present. And I think that beginning sort of tells you that the show is trying to present something that has a little more, perhaps a little more roots in it to the very old show. The choice of the music, the opening sequence to me, I mean, you're right, the Cushing, it's got the colours of the Cushing, but it has a sort of symmetrical effects that you had in the 60s show. So obviously it's trying to tell you that, you know, to me it's trying to tell me that we're going back to a sort of 60s format, and obviously with the Companions of Three as well, there is a feeling of that sort of movement, and maybe also into the pace, which we'll probably talk about as well.
Mm. Maybe this is a good time to just briefly sidestep to London 1965 then.
Oh yes, what, William Russell?
Yeah.
Yes, that was amusing.
So if you don't know, you may have heard of the hashtag London 1965 thing that took place during the Twitch reruns of classic Doctor Who. And I think over the weekend, esteemed actor William Russell exclaimed it once more. For an upload onto Twitter.
He looked wonderfully bewildered as well, so he wasn't quite sure why he was having to do this. But, you know, he's got to the point now where he is complicit in Doctor Who, so he'll just do as he's told.
Yeah.
But it is fascinating to see that sort of thing happen, and I know I've said this many times before, but we live in an age of culture, and obviously television and film, but not just television and film, where you can have this sort of really weird situation where you're getting these sort of, I don't know, these sort of obviously intertextual sort of callbacks that you wouldn't really have at any other period, because you just didn't have that, to sort of transcend those medias like that with the original cast. So it's not just even like it's an author thing. It's a cast thing. We see it so much now, we get used to it. But you'd have never, I mean, to put it into context, if you're back in 1963, you would never imagine hearing that phrase in 1965, that in sort of 53 years, that phrase would be uttered again in celebration of that moment. You know, that sort of stuff never really happened before in history. It's a really
or that it could be transferred via a phone line into a snazzy television.
Absolutely. And of course, by coming out of a sort of this sort of interaction within fan cultures over a sort of retrospective watch of the show, which most people watching it knew already, and that sort of almost transforming that moment. I mean, I've seen that moment 100 times, you know, loads of times.
Yeah,
and suddenly that moment now creates new meaning through this sort of fan interaction, which therefore spawns this response from the original actor. It's a very, very weird, mixed up world we live in, sort of the way all this stuff feeds back in on itself. It's fascinating. And incredible, really, as well.
Pop eating itself.
It is. It literally, it's the pop eating. It's that sort of postmodern pop, the pop eating itself sort of thing. We are consuming the stuff that we consumed. We're regurgitating the stuff we've consumed and then reconsuming it.
It's cool.
Yes.
Okay, so let's sidestep back to the ghost monuments and William Russell's modern day equivalent, who I suppose
must Bradley be. Walsh.
Well, no.
What do you think is?
Well, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because it could be Ryan or it could be Graham, and it's obviously one of them. And obviously the doctor is Susan, and Yasmin is Barbara. No, I don't know.
It doesn't quite transcend, does it?
Does it? No, it doesn't. Well, listen, 7.1 million people tuned in. I'd be interested to see the full set of figures for these, and whether or not these are these are maximums or are they averages? Because it was a very slow episode again, and you know there's a lot of things that are good about this, and for instance, the guest cast are superb, but there's a few things that aren't so good. It's reminded me, in many ways, or in some ways, in a particularly striking way, of a New Adventures novel.
There's a few
of these which have like this single concept. There's a bit of sci-fi thrown in, but there's a lot of meandering of getting from A to B to reach the end. And there was a feeling of that in this. And that's not necessarily bad, but at the same time, not necessarily from the novels, whether Virgin or BBC's era, either their real strong points, where there's kind of two or three strong points throughout the run in the novels. So that was that struck me. I'm really not sure about the robots, to be honest with you. But Sean Dooley was excellent, I thought. I mean, he always is. You know, he's a good, reliable character actor. Art Malik was Art Malik, but again, excellent. And Susan Lynch probably. Possibly for me, just Ed Sean Dooley. But I don't know. I don't want to come to my definitive conclusion on this just yet. I'm going to give you a chance to.
I don't know. I mean, it is definitely a slower paced show. But to be fair, series. I keep thinking what series we're on now. Is this series 10?
This is 11. So
that's series 11. 10. So series 10 had some moments, especially in the early ones, which had this sort of pace. I felt so. I think it's that hard thing, and it's a hard thing, I think, for people who watch this show to sort of get their head round. Because on one hand, you've got the fact that there's been a lot of frustration that the Doctor Who since 2005 has been a sort of very fast pace. You know, the sonic screwdriver is used too much. And the reason the sonic screwdriver is used too much, as we've said before, is because it's moving so fast it can't afford to stop to sort of try and find ingenious ways to get through a door or to get information. So that device becomes the way to move through that bit to the next point of the plot. Mm. So you've now got a situation where that's been pulled right back. And so you've got something which is actually a little more like the old show. I mean, you said you get this bit in the middle where there's a sort of meandering. Well, that is really much most that I can think of. You know, even things like Paradise Towers, I'm just off the top of my head. You have a good beginning. You have quite a strong ending. But the middle bit is something you could either make long or short because it is just running around up and down. And Tom Baker's era, Troughton's era onwards did this a lot. It's a kind of weird thing. I'm not sure whether it's just not being used to it. There is obviously that same question as we had last week. And, you know, is it, and I've seen this reflected on either Twitter or Facebook, is it fast enough for young kids to get involved into? Is it, does it carry enough? I don't know. I liked it. I enjoyed it. It didn't blow me away, but then nothing Doctor Who has blown me away for a while. But I like the tone. I like the pacing. I like the characterizations. I think the companions are fairly interesting. I think Bradley Walsh really is a godsend to that teaming. He sort of does bring a lot. Ryan is good. There's a sort of vulnerability there. I like the fact that they don't always do things right, like when he jumps out with the gun. It proves a sort of long-term Doctor point, which, we'll be honest, has never been totally true to the character. Occasionally has picked up a gun when it's suited. But I think it's nice to have companions which aren't there to just win the day, which was another criticism that's been of late, hasn't it, in the last 15 years.
Yeah.
That the companions are doing the new adventures thing and becoming very overly central to the point of resolving the plot. So I like that they've not really got that sort of moving. The two things I didn't like are actually callbacks to the new series, which I was hoping we'd got beyond. Actually, no, that's not entirely true. Maybe one thing. Two things. Actually, it's two things. Spanish Inquisition. It's, I thought the reference to, was it Timeless Child? I can't remember what it was. I felt that. And I really did not like this feeling that there was going to be a story arc through this series. I thought we got past that.
Mm-hmm.
And while some people might like that, and it's obviously very good for generating buzz in social media and in, if there's any forums left, assume there are forums, they just never work.
The thing about this as well is that, someone might come along and say, you know, Chibnall might come along later on and announce on the press release saying, or on Twitter, or whoever, whatever, means said, oh, it's not story arc. But the fact that this thing has been mentioned in two episodes.
Was it mentioned in a previous episode as well?
What are we talking about?
Timeless.
No, I'm talking about the Stenza.
Well, actually, that was my second point.
Yeah.
So, yes, we can walk into that, and that is, yes, the reuse. I just feel the show was, and it seemed to be arguing that it was going to be, something which was really just standalone stories that didn't sort of have any sort of arc linked to them.
And we've got Galactic Terminators wandering around the place, haven't we?
And suddenly, yes, we have this new Galactic Terminators wandering around the place, and on top of that, you've got this sort of reference that could be just something which disappears and reappears in another season. But it feels almost like the Bad Wolf thing happening again. And it's just like, those are sort of two things the show doesn't need. It doesn't need continual enemies, just simply because it's exploring not just the universe, but time.
Yeah.
You don't have a shortage of things to have to be an enemy.
Absolutely.
And that's not even before you go into your back catalogue. So, yeah, I just felt that was a bit, do we need to truncate this universe? Do we need to make it feel smaller?
We've talked about story arcs in classic Doctor Who on a few occasions, and there really aren't that many over 26 years. There is, there's Key to Time, obviously. There is, I suppose, the original aim of getting Ian and Barbara back to Earth. There is the green agenda of Barry Letts. There's a bit of trying to get Tegan to Heathrow. There's the Loose Ace thing and the Trial of the Time Lord and the Key to Time. That's about it, isn't it?
Well, I think you've reached quite heavily there as well, to be fair.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say the only ones I can think of is maybe, you could argue, Mission to the Unknown and Dalek's Dalek's Master Plan.
Yeah.
You could argue Metabilis being almost, it's not a story arc, but it does invariably lead to something.
It's a motivation, isn't it? That carries over.
Arc in space, that period, I suppose, is a story arc. Key to time, as you say. You could perhaps argue e-space, well, you would argue e-space.
Yeah, of course.
And then, yes, the Black Guardian trilogy. But as you say, they're very slim and they don't last very long. And it's a different way of doing the show. But this just feels like you just don't need to bookend these sort of shows. And as we've said this before, you do need a good out show. You need a good finale to get people to wanting to come back. But that doesn't mean this sort of, I don't know, it just feels like a very waning marketing tactic.
Yes.
That's what it feels like to me. It's a way to start generating sort of chatter, discourse with the fan elements and to sort of encourage magazine articles in what is the question mark? When is Rose coming back? You know, it's those sort of things. What is Bad Wolf? And there's not many which I feel has ever looked back and gone, yeah, that was actually, as part of the actual story, worth doing. With perhaps the exception of maybe Harold Saxon and maybe Bad Wolf. But even in those cases, with Harold Saxon, I don't think you needed him punctuating that series particularly, but I think that sort of kind of worked.
Well, I think he overshadows it anyway, so...
Yes.
You know, I mean, he's only in three episodes, isn't he? So, you know, physically, you know, you can feel his presence without him being there, which I think is kind of cool. Looking back, having watched Series 4 quite recently, I think The Missing Planets works quite well as well. I know very few was enthused by the way the story ends in terms of dealing with the Daleks, but everything that leads up to that is like throwaway, and then it turns out to mean something. I think that works quite well.
Okay. So, I mean, maybe sometimes it can work. I think if it was, again, not wanting to sort of champion...
I mean, the Torchwood one did my head in, and it still does, so...
Well, the Torchwood always does people's head in.
Because, you know, it was there, and it advertised another series in every episode of Doctor Who, essentially, in essence, so...
Yes, yeah, no,
that
persuaded
me.
Yeah, it was a real sort of backdoor piloty sort of thing. And again, I think, as I said, without championing the old show, because it wasn't trying to do this, and nor am I hate the fact that we talk about the old show like 26 years all in one thing and sort of say it's not a whole, you know, entity. But I think if it happened occasionally, I wouldn't mind. Like if it didn't happen this series and then they had a story arc or... A story. It's not even a story arc. It's sort of like a portent of for the finale being played in. That wouldn't bother me, but it's because it becomes a sort of so patternized that it becomes frustrating. You start to be able to see the markers, and you shouldn't really be able to see the markers, especially with this show. And I think that is what frustrates me. As soon as they say a comment's made, and they go, the Doctor will inevitably go, "What? What's that?" You know this is a marker for the finale. And maybe this will subvert that expectation. It will never be mentioned again. But that sort of frustrates me. It's like you don't ignore the past show. Do something new. So, the main creatures. I'm hoping, by the feels of it, they're still going to play this She Can't Get Them Home, which I'd be very surprised if they don't play that, since they're pulling out all these 60s markers. And that would be interesting, because I don't get the impression next week that they're going where they want to go.
No.
So I think it's a funny situation. I just hope that he carries on trying to defy the old show, even if it's not successful occasionally. And obviously, as you found last week, you weren't quite happy with last week. As long as they're trying to do something different, I think that's what's important. And 7.1 on the overnights isn't bad for a second week. It's not a gigantic drop off from an opener. So I think they'll be fairly happy with that once the consolidateds come in.
Yeah. Whilst we're, again, I don't want to go too much into things, and we've got some comments from Facebook to look at as well, shortly, from our listeners. But, I mean, we've obviously got, we got to the end of the episode, and there's various things to talk about, the end of the episode, and the rather obvious destination of the episode.
Uh-huh.
But when you get there, into a room full of hubcaps, how did you feel?
Well, I'm sure, like you, I had seen the
No, I hadn't seen
You them. Hadn't?
No, okay. I hadn't.
Have you seen them since?
No, I haven't, no.
Okay. I mean, I'm careful what I say here. Because it feels really brutal to say it, and I hate people who are really brutal like this.
Yeah.
I don't like that set at all.
Okay.
From a designer point of view, I don't get it. I think once you go into post-production and you match up tones and you get a consistencies throughout and you amp up the contrasts of gold and blue, which is very familiar to film and television these days, you can make anything look pretty good. So I think on the screen it didn't look bad. I think it looked interesting on the screen. I was aware that they were using very tight shots. You didn't get any really long ones, and you only got very quick glimpses of anything for any long period. And like I said, I think there's been a lot of work done in post. But those cold shots of the set, those ones which haven't been wetted up, you know, with post-production lighting. It's an ugly set,
mm-hmm.
and that concerns me so far, is if your set is fairly ugly, a different director, the way it's lit, can perhaps look less effective. And we've all seen shows where you have a really nice opening where, you could even argue this for the Eccleston console, where its initial lighting gets shifted and it starts to look a little less magical.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because this has got a very, very weird flaw in those dropped photos. The colour of the floor is very flat. It has this very brass middle structure with, as you say, this very odd ornate section that goes around it, which looks like it doesn't have any backing to it, which is, again, it's fine. And then you have I think the thing for me is the claws. The claws don't match the shape of the room. They don't match the shape of the console. So it feels like there's like three elements. There's this pseudo-industrial element for the outside, this crystal element for the middle, this steampunk sort of metallic workings around the actual console itself, and then these very weird crystal elements as well. And then this very, very flat floor with a very, very flat texture to it, which, again, like I say, when they on the screen, it doesn't look so bad. And again, this is unfair in some. I think the reason I feel bad saying this is that those images shouldn't have come out for us to be able to look at and then compare. Do you know what I mean? It feels it's putting extra pressure on the show to actually. Well, it shouldn't have had to have it. Now, I'm not a set designer. I don't work in sets. I don't work in set production. So maybe I'm just being very unfair here. I mean, no set looks brilliant once you take the lights off. But some sets don't look bad. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when you take the lights off this, it doesn't look very good. And I think that's not because the bits are wrong. I just wonder whether the bits just don't really marry together unless you put a lot of work into how you light it and how you sort of filter it in post. And that's my concern with it. It looked fine on screen. And to say the end result, I have no issues with. It looked quite majestic, quite unusual. And maybe the designers were very, very aware of post-production. And that was what they were after. And they knew exactly what they were going to do. And it's just one of those things that when you take away the sheen, it just looks a bit rubbish. But in fact, it's always going to be there with a sheen, so that doesn't matter. It could be that, and I could be being horrendously unfair. But to me, someone who dabbled in design for a while, it's not so much how it looked cold. It's more the fact that I don't think those elements work together, personally. And so even though it looks a little better on screen, I have an issue with the design on that reason. And in a sense, I suppose those cold photos just made me feel it sort of validated my concerns, because I could see all those elements very clearly and why I didn't like them. And that's perhaps where I'm coming from, which is probably, as I say, that's why I think I feel bad, because it's stuff that dropped, which perhaps shouldn't have dropped to give this sort of situation. But I think as long as it looks good on screen and it looks professional, then that's fine. But I think compared to the previous console, which I was never a massive fan of, to be honest, to me everything was way too complicated and it was way too big. But I've always hated static rotors. I don't know why that is, but this just feels a bit, I don't know. That being said, I thought some of the actual stuff on the actual console, some of the lines and the way that it was all sort of, the brass linings and the controls look quite nice. They look quite interesting. I loathe the custom cream.
I'm not keen on the sand timer either, to be honest. It seems to be on the nose.
I loathe the sand timer. I mean, it's just like, it's just such a coy thing, isn't it? Sand timers measure time. Therefore, a time machine will have one. And it's just like, I don't know. That just feels like, I don't know. The door to my house lets me into my room, so I'll put a door on my car. You know, a front door or something. I don't know. It's just one of those things that we accept, but it's absolutely absurd. It just feels.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like the 1996, isn't it? It's the same sort of.
Yeah. I don't know. I
know you love the design.
With this one, it feels a bit too close to the first Matt Smith one, to be honest with you.
It
feels a bit random and. You know, I feel that maybe it's trying too hard. I'd just like something to go back to the original console.
So someone said to me they just like the idea that he redesigns them. And, you know, like Five Doctors, I guess. I kind of prefer. I think the thing that gets me, if we're going to get really, really fanal about this, I like that word, I'm going to use that a lot.
Fanal?
It's fan and anal. Is that the Doctor is an eccentric character. We get that. But its actual core is in a lot of ways is a scientist. He's fascinated in science. He's fascinated or always a learned person, shall we say. So I tend to think in the Five Doctors where he sort of redoes the console and it is very sterile. That kind of makes sense to me. Because he is a man and a woman who has a sort of rationality of science to them. I think the eccentricities of him, or her, are just somehow a part of his character and aesthetic, or her character and aesthetic. I have to stop doing this. But they're not part of the way that they work. Does that make sense? I mean, yes, there's the MacGuffin element where the Doctor can create loads of things out of nothing, you know, sonic screwdriver out of Sheffield spoons. That's absolutely fine, and that's meant to show ingenuity. But in assumption is that with a console, with a TARDIS, he wouldn't need to have that ingenuity. He wouldn't need to have a typewriter as part of a console because it's the technology so beyond that. Yeah. And I don't think he'd have an... I just don't feel that he would need the aesthetic of it. It just doesn't feel... I understand why they do it, and I understand that after Tom Baker that there was this real need to sort of hamp up the fact that he was childish and he'd have jelly babies on him and he had a long scarf, so he was obviously quite weird and he loved sort of nuancy things. But I don't know. Maybe that's me. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, it's a character, so you can interpret it as however you want. And I can see people rationally interpreting that he is a man or woman who does love aesthetics in a lot of ways and always has. But at the same time, I kind of like the fact that TARDIS was sterile because that was, in a sense, part of who he was as well, that he comes from a sterile civilization in a weird way. I don't know, maybe that would feel quite homely to him in a lot of ways. Maybe they would argue that it's right, that as he's got older, as it's got older, the Doctor's got older, is becoming more stylized in its old age.
Maybe, and of course, of course, the civilization isn't sterile anymore, is it? As of the day,
I was obviously meaning more aesthetically, but yeah.
Oh, right, okay, yeah.
Obviously, figuratively and literally sterile was perhaps.
But that could have been the Daleks could have done that. That could have been just a result of a time war. One day, all these old Time Lords are wandering around, and you know, they wake up the next day, and they've all got families and children.
And because it's time, they wake up yesterday and find they were sterile then as well. You know, back and forth.
Yeah. As far as the control of the interior of the TARDIS, I'm not sure about the. It feels a bit like. Well, here's the thing. I live in Redcar, and one of our previous MPs was Mo Molum.
Yep.
And her house in Redcar was along Redcar Promenade, and it had rather a noticeable front porch. Noticeable for two reasons. It was white. It was all, like, brand new UPVC. And, obviously, it had an armed guard, an armed policeman stood outside, because she was involved with the Northern Ireland peace process. And then there's, like, quite a large house inside. And that's what the TARDIS felt like to me as she walked in to this porch. And then this big room inside, it reminded me of a house with a huge porch, rather than, you know, going straight in. And obviously, I think the writing's been on the wall. I think it's just a progression of, you know, from the 2005 TARDIS to the 2013 TARDIS. 2013? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was 2013, wasn't it? It was Matt Smith's TARDIS before it was Capaldi's, wasn't it? With that sort of blending of the door into the room, those little lines, and then into this new thing where you've got the entire box and then the TARDIS as the TARDIS interior. So I think it doesn't feel as smooth and effortless as before. It looks a bit easier possibly from a cinematic point of view.
I think that's the reason. So you just have a flat back to the police box.
Yeah.
When on location. I imagine that's the reason this has been done this way.
Yeah. I'm not a fan of whatever round things are in the TARDIS at the moment. They do look like, you know, wheel trims from a sports vehicle. But I do like the sort of partitioning elements of it, that sort of ring wall that feels a bit, going back to the 1960s TARDIS, it feels, I think, gives it some extra, at least an impression of extra space inside, making it appear larger than it is. But also, it reminded me also of the Gothic control room from the Hinchcliffe era as well.
I mean, I think I agree with you. I like the layering of the walls, because I think that does give a sense, almost a very weird illusionary sort of feel that these walls could almost go back forever. There's a sort of weird sort of illusion the way that they overlap, which is really nice. I think some really nice design elements in there, except for those claws. And today, the designer or the concept designer actually put up on Twitter his concept design that led to this. And the claws look a little better on there. But I'll be very interested to see how they shoot this console, because with those claws as they are and the way they're angled so tight to this console and with the shape of the room, it's going to be very interesting to see where they get their angles. And because it's now a flat floor, so you've not got the multi-levels to play with either, which again goes back to 2005, so it's nothing particularly new, but I'll be interested to see how they use this set, and I think that's going to be interesting to me, because obviously I'm coming with these assumptions and these assertions, which the show could prove me invalid and prove me wrong and actually show how they can use this. But it's just those shapes in there, sort of that round room with these very awkward angled claws, which to me, just, I think they're what do it for me. Those claws just look out of place in that room. Crystal claws. And hopefully, part of me hopes if they carry on with this design, maybe they'll fall off or disappear. A bit
crystal
like
claws sounds like a Scooby-Doo monster, sorry.
Yes. I mean, it'd be interesting. I thought, are they going to move? Because they look like they hinge, but I don't think they do. And if they did, I'm not really sure what they're going to do, which is of interest. But, I don't know. It just, it's an odd room. I can see what they're doing, and I admire the originality in the actual concept design. I'm just not quite sure as an actual physical space it's really great, but we will see. I liked the shots that they did in it. As I said, like when she walked in, I thought the exterior, the way the exterior to the interior looked really great. The lighting of the out as she was coming in, I thought that was beautiful. Just not sure about the elements of the console. I don't like the console itself. I don't like crystalline.
Okay.
Do you? I mean, you see it's a big, thick crystalline.
It doesn't feel too far. Well, yeah, it's. What I like about it is the arrangement of everything. What I don't like are the details, basically.
Well, this is it. I mean, if they'd done a purely crystalline TARDIS, I could have probably got behind it. Or totally brass steampunk. Or totally industrial. But it's this odd sort of marrying of the load. The gold and the blue work very well, but then those are sort of complementary colours which TV use all the time. So that's not fantastically original. My other problem, and this is probably going to make people feel a bit ill. Do you remember that Blackadder episode where, I think it was Blackadder, where is it Baldrick has a certain candle?
Has a what?
Is it Baldrick? I'm just trying to think. Is it Blackadder, Baldrick, with the candle?
Isn't there
a candle of earwax?
Candle of earwax?
Where's that from? Is it Blackadder?
Oh.
I need to find out now.
I wouldn't rule it out. It's not catching me, though.
It's on something. It's something where... I want to know where it is now, but it was really gross. It made me, and somehow the actual rotor reminds me of that prop. Perhaps it wasn't Blackadder. What was it, though? It was something which was like, no, that's wrong. Maybe it wasn't. It wasn't Blackadder. I'll think about that.
Are you sure you didn't dream it?
I'm hoping I didn't. So what else was there in the episode that's worth it? I like the cat. I like the dynamics. I think it's very interesting. Is it Graham and Ryan? I think their relationship is quite something you don't tend to see on television played out.
Stepfather. Well, yeah. I mean, as we near this conversation, the elephant in the room for me is trumpeting and stamping its feet.
What's that?
So I'm going to have to say it. Two episodes in, and Jodie Whittaker feels like a guest in her own show.
I'm afraid. See.
Well, it is a bit, yeah. But I mean, if Bradley Walsh wasn't in this, I think this would be really struggling to go anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I know. Bradley Walsh is kind of a divisive character. Because people see him as a game show host, whereas you know before that he was. An actor and a light entertainer, and of course before that he was a footballer. So I know he's not everyone's cup of tea, but he has a massive collection of fans, and you know, you've got 7.1 people watching Doctor Who and another 4.9 people watching The Chase at the same time. All watching Bradley Walsh. And you know, some people would have tuned into Doctor Who for Bradley Walsh, I've absolutely no doubt. And that relationship, with the step grandson, and just generally his entire, you know, he's carrying it, and that feels wrong at this stage. I don't, you know, a doctor should be coming in and hitting the ground running, and I don't think she has.
Well, I mean, a lot of people,
and I'm not entirely blaming her, because some of the dialogue she's been given has been absolutely fanfictrocious. Seriously, you can see it early in this episode, and a couple of times in The Woman Who Fell to Earth, she is doing lines which she's not convincing herself with. So I don't know how she's convincing anyone else with.
Any specifics?
I can't think of one from this week. Last week, the thing about helping people wherever she goes, that thing, there's a lot of cheese to it, and there was another one this week along similar lines, I think. But you know, Chris Chibnall hasn't written a decent episode of Doctor Who still, and I'm glad that there's someone else coming along next week to write it.
Basically, it'll be interesting to see what they do.
Yeah.
I mean, some of Chibnall's. I never liked anything done for Torchwood, but I did like 42.
I don't mind 42. 42's good. So maybe he has written a decent episode of Doctor Who. Unfortunately, it was 10 years ago. Maybe that's or 11 years ago, or maybe he even wrote it in 2006, or it was 12 years ago. I liked Cyberwoman. I'm one of the rare people who liked Cyberwoman.
No, I liked Cyberwoman as well. I mean, yes, the actual costume was ridiculous, but the actual story was very strong.
Yeah. Again, a long time ago.
Interesting on the console, there is actually a Step Inside the TARDIS Doctor Who video that's on Twitter, which is probably on the main website as well. Which has the production designer and shots of the console as well.
Oh, yes, I've got a bit of that, yeah.
Yeah, and again, actually, in the actual shots of the footage, it actually looks quite... I don't mind it. I actually quite like the shape of the actual console itself. Like I say, so damn claws and stupid timer and that weird police box that rotates. Slow, what's that about? It's very odd. But,
what do you think of the exterior, then?
I prefer it. I mean, I think its scale is... I mean, it looks like it's been scaled down a bit in size to probably match the smaller size of the actor playing the character.
Mm.
I think, again, whether I like it particularly or not, I think I like the weathering on it. Yeah, I think it's okay. I think, again, it's the fact it's something different. And again, with the console, I am glad that they're not... There's a part of me which was hoping to see something a little more retro, just... But at the same time, I'm kind of glad that they're trying something different once more. I think, again, we just need to keep pushing the show to keep trying to do different things. And sometimes, as in its history, that doesn't work. Sometimes it does.
Yeah.
Hopefully things are starting to come together.
Okay.
I mean, I agree with you perhaps with a couple of the lines. I can't think of ones in particular, but there's a couple of lines in the last two episodes which I have felt that it's not her, it's that they're trying too hard to sort of, I don't know, match what the Doctor's meant to be.
I think...
what she does.
You know, a lot of people say, you know, I mean, this might even come up when we spoke to Philip Martin and Tim Gallagher about the Doctor basically being the Doctor, and, you know, you can give any Doctor's dialogue to another Doctor. But, you know, there's lines that come out of Jodie Whittaker's mouth as if they're written for Matt Smith or David Tennant, so maybe they're just how she's interpreting them and she's... You know, feeling around for the character still.
At the same time, and that could be the case, but I felt that a bit with Capaldi. I mean, there were times, especially, even though Capaldi often was written to be more like Malcolm Tucker, there were times where you felt like they were playing him like a Matt Smith, which to me never felt like what he was. And it wasn't, again, as we've said before, to that last series where he seemed to settle down and find that element that is between Tucker and this... traditional Doctor Who archetype, which is him. And the same happened for Sylvester McCoy. As I said to you before, I still feel Eccleston occasionally had it. I think the problem is, I think some actors, like David Tennant played a very much a Tom Baker Doctor Who. I mean, he was obviously very different to Tom Baker, but he was playing that sort of energy and then that mixture of going back between silliness and seriousness, which Baker did very well. And so I think he naturally became that character very easily. I think Matt Smith, again, when he was originally written, he was written very much as a sort of very, almost slightly vacuous Doctor. And it wasn't until later did he get an opportunity to start playing around and doing something deeper. So I think it does take time for the writers and the actor to find those elements which suit that character. Because I think, yes, you're right, they should all be the same to a degree. But they're not. And the way the actors work them is different. And you can see that when you've seen those fan conventions where they'll get previous Doctors to do the lines of a Doctor that's current, say, the Rings of Akatan speech. I think Sylvester McCoy, I think Colin Baker, I think a few of them have done. And you can hear the different inflections and the way they do them. So, I don't know. I think a lot of it is this this problem that the show feels this need perhaps to over accentuate who she's meant to be.
Yeah.
And I don't think it needs to do that. I don't think it's her fault. I think it's the writing perhaps being a little overzealous and trying to predict what the Doctor should be. And I think it's going to be if she does another series, I think then we'll see something which is more her, when they'll actually look back and go, actually, that's this Doctor. That's what it's about.
Yeah.
And we'll do that. And we'll take away this. I don't think there's times where they drop in moments of authority, which I don't think she needs. I think she's a character which doesn't need to shout. I think her power would be in not shouting and just doing.
Mm-hmm.
And those moments to me feel like that's been written for someone else rather than her, or written for the character rather than the way that she would play the character.
Yeah.
Because like we say, Capaldi's very different in his last series to his first.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think while I like a lot of the stuff he does in the first, the third is the one where I think he feels more natural, where he feels like he's got the role as he wants it, where it's got a sort of quiet authority rather than a sort of angry authority. So, yeah, I think it depends. I'm talking a lot today.
You are, which is good. It's good. Right, we're going to hit Facebook, because we have people on Facebook who are telling us how they feel about this episode. Trevor Arthur. A damn good yarn, and we found an army that has worse aim than Imperial troopers. That's a Star Wars reference.
That is true.
Yes. Tom Ford enjoyed the first 10 minutes, but felt the momentum slowed down considerably once they landed on the planet. Felt it was still too slow to keep the attention of younger viewers, which for the second week running isn't a good sign. Now, I sat on the floor in the same position with my boy last night as I did the week before on beanbags. Beanbags. For children, so obviously I was in considerable discomfort, and he got into it quicker. I think the opening titles obviously helped. He showed no sign this week of being bored. He didn't talk for a good 15 minutes to ask a question. Anyone who has a 7 or 8 year old will probably know that children do tend to ask a lot of questions when you're trying to watch something. The beauty of this is that because I haven't seen it, I can say to him, I don't know, I haven't seen it. So that's useful. So, I can't agree on the attention thing at this point. Maybe as well he's quite excited about the fact that he's actually watching brand new Doctor Who, which he's never really done before. It's always been pre-watched by an adult first.
Right.
Or watched on iPlayer or whatever. So that's interesting. Nick Caulfield enjoyed it, although the sniper bot shooting was straight out of the A-team. And since it had to be, that sequence had less jeopardy. I'm not sure. I don't remember any sniper robots in the A-team.
No, but I suppose he means like the previous person was that this is, you know, there's a certain amount of disbelief that they couldn't hit anything.
Yeah, yeah. A little concern that the second reference to the Stens in as many stories implies a story arc, which I was hoping we'd get a break from.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hames Bell believes it looks wonderfully cinematic. It does. But felt it was lacking somewhat story-wise. I think it'd be difficult to argue with that, to be honest. There's lots of beautiful, beautiful shots in there. And there is, and I mentioned this I've mentioned this previously, I don't know. There is that cinematic Game of Thrones-esque scale to the cinematography in this and last week's episode.
Yeah.
It does feel grand and big and large, but unlike Game of Thrones, or certainly unlike the key Game of Thrones episodes, it does feel as though it's more style over substance.
I think one of the problems here is that as soon as you do something which is on location, away, totally on location, away from the UK, I imagine that sort of limits how many stars you're going to have out there. Mm. So it limits to how many characters you've got to play with, to how much jeopardy you can put in there. And that probably is a factor that sort of plays into the choices here. And maybe if you'd done it at home, you wouldn't have had the gloriousness as you had in this. Would you have had more cast in there that perhaps would have created more jeopardy? Maybe. I don't know. I know Doctor Who, you've got to do this the whole time. I mean, how many times have we seen bad shooting? I mean, you can go back to the very classic invasion Troughton running, jumping as he's being attacked by Cybermen. But yeah, somehow I kind of felt there was a lot of... You had to suspend disbelief a little bit that no one was hit.
Yeah, maybe if there'd been fewer of them, it would have been more realistic. But yeah,
maybe they were just very rusty and out of.
Well, there you go. Yeah, maybe. Actually, no. Andrew G. Dick says before becoming showrunner, Chris Chibnall hadn't written a good episode of Doctor Who. He still hasn't. Yeah, well, I think we've established probably 42 was his good episode. But Gary Akers really enjoyed it as a slower-paced character piece after last week's frenetic runaround. Whitaker is absolutely fantastic, as is Bradley Walsh, quickly emerging as the main companion. The two younger pals get nothing to do. Was four leads really the way to go? We'll know the answer to that at the end of the series, I think.
Probably, but I still like it. I mean, I've found one of the things I've hated in Doctor Who is the single female companion.
Yeah, yeah.
In 2005 onwards, where they become this, like we said before, this backpacker mentality where they're going to see the universe. The universe is their oyster. It's a real sort of arrogant, westernized view of globe-trotting, where that Western ideology can be taken to various places, and you can sort of look down and see how these people are living before you move on to the next exciting place. Yeah. And it's sort of irritating. It's sort of so middle class and cocky. To have something which has four people who are a little less sure, who struggle. I mean, Dyspraxia is still there, which I think is good. And we've obviously got the cancer, which is sort of slightly hinted at maybe in this episode. So I think the fall works for me. In the same way that, I mean, you could argue, when you were saying earlier, that Jodie feels like a guest star, but then kind of in the original series, it was Chesterton, wasn't it, who was leading the whole show.
Well, he was the biggest TV star, wasn't he?
Absolutely. So, and he was a big name in himself, or biggish name. And the way the character played was very much at the forefront.
Yeah.
Both because we were leading through him, and because he was the proactive force that was pushing the story along, by and large. So I think it's still dropping back to that, and I'm good with that, as long as you've got, as you say, good characters to do it, and Bradley Walsh is good. I think Ryan is good. Yaz, I'm not so sold on yet. But then I think it's kind of nice to have two male characters pushing as companions, coming forward, and creating a different dynamic, and having a female doctor. I think it's interesting.
Phil Vernon wants to like it more than he does. He's not keen on the four leads because he doesn't feel it's clicking. Chibnall seems to have adopted the Dan Brown school of writing, with characters standing around and explaining the plot. I think he's not alone in that. Also, plenty of obvious plot points, which kind of alluded to earlier, didn't we? The Ghost Monument appears every 1,000 years or days, whatever it was. Honk, TARDIS klaxon. An exploding cigar. I wonder if that will be useful later. I don't think it's unreasonable to expect better writing. This is me speaking now. And, you know, we've had it at times in the last series. I think possibly the last two episodes prior to this haven't really delivered. So it's a long time since we have had a really good episode of Doctor Who. You know, the first part of the Master Missy Cyberman episode.
That was excellent, yeah.
Was superb. Absolutely superb.
But that was a standout. I'd not seen one as good as that for a while. So,
yeah.
I mean, there were some good ones that series. I'm not saying there weren't, but I mean, this is probably where the quartet will perhaps become a bit of an issue. This is, I think, what the show needs to do now is to, as I think they're doing next week, is drop them into a civilization, so there's more characters for it to play with. Which in the last two episodes, it's been a little more sparse. But when you've got four central, it does make it harder to do that, but not impossible. I mean, a lot of shows have ensemble casts of four people at the very least.
I'm very worried about next week, to be honest with you. Obviously, I haven't seen it, but we know the setting. I have this dreadful, dreadful fear that time travellers are going to be responsible for the civil rights movement.
Yeah, that would be a bit crass. We'll see.
A bit? So, I am worried about that. I mean, it's not totally unusual territory, because I think Quantum Leap did it as well, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And looking back, I've never really realised how quite awful that actually is.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, because there's a couple. I mean, there was the LA Riots one, wasn't there? Was it LA Riots?
I'm not sure if it's LA Riots.
It wasn't LA, was it? It was 60s.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of 90s LA Riots. Yeah. But there was a couple where, yes, he plays a key role, having jumped in to a person of colour, and is, maybe. I don't know, we'll have to see. But then that's an interesting point, and I'll be interesting to see how they play that, because I'm sure they'll have to be very wary of where we sit now, and responsible too.
Yes.
Because it's not about it being, as some people would scream, politically correct. There is a responsibility to show an understanding of how certain points in history carry extreme significance, because they still sit on tenuous grounds, a lot of tension around them, and understandably too. So, I think it will have to be careful there. We'll see.
Yes. Now, we're running out of time, so we should probably come together and express our individual ratings for this episode. Oof. I suppose. I'll tell you what I'll do. Before we do that, I'll just while you gather your thoughts, next week's episode is simply called Rosa, and is credited according, this is interesting, going back to some previous conversations on previous podcasts, is credited to Mallory Blackman and Chris Chibnall, according to Wikipedia.
Okay.
So we've obviously had conversations about showrunners, sticking names, sharing credits. Yeah, Mallory Blackman was children's laureate from 2013 to 2015. So she's primarily a children's writer, and she's written literature and television drama for children and young adults. So she is the hands writing next week's episode. You should basically look up her library; it's absolutely huge. List of credits and titles. I'll kick off.
Okay.
I feel that this episode is better than last week's episode. I'd give it 5 out of 10. I am a little bit concerned. There was a kind of hard sci-fi element to it, in terms of not hard sci-fi literary, but hard sci-fi for television. It felt one of the most sci-fi episodes of Doctor Who. Certainly in a long time, if not ever. There's a lot of sci-fi tropes in there, this galactic race, robots, sentient nano-control, presumably bits of cloth and holograms across the universe, a bit like The Last Jedi, and blasters, and interesting alien civilizations. So there is some nice world building going on in this episode, The Ghost Monument. But great guest cast. I just do think it is a bit too slow and not enough happens. But, 5 out of 10 for me.
I think it's, given they still seem very keen on their mid-demograph of sort of that, early teens, to 20s, that seems to be still key. I think it probably fits in with that, so far as I'm thinking of Netflix content, mm-hmm. which tends to be a little more slower paced these days, if you think of the Marvel things like Daredevil and the Marvel franchises on there. So it's probably feeling it can sort of slow the pace down and feel in keeping with that flow of VOD content, and also obviously that is helps on a budgetary scale too, because you can slow down what you need to be doing. I liked it. I didn't feel underconfident with it. I mean, there's a lot of stuff on that I'm watching at the moment, which I won't say it blew me away, but I do feel that it's still got a fresh element, and I reward it for that. I think that keeps me interested. While last year I was constantly battling with the fact that Bill, while interesting, was still playing the same archetype as previous companions. And so I was constantly having to sort of sit there and negotiate whether how much I enjoyed this character, how much I felt I was reliving the same thing. this feels different, and I really thank the show for doing something a little different with the central character dynamics.
Yeah,
it was a little slow in places. My only real grumble, though, as I said, is this harking to story arcs, and I don't feel I can particularly knock it for that. Yes, I agree with people saying that the poor shooting felt a little like they were having to stretch the suspension of disbelief, given they were in open areas.
Yeah.
They weren't in corridors, you know, where there were lots of turns or anything. They were very open, very clean shots. I think I'd probably give it 7.9. Not quite an 8, but it was the characters were enough to make it interesting. The story didn't blow me away. I'm never particularly keen on these sort of game arena stories anyway, but it looked good. It felt good. I still hope that they sort of try and that they rework her script to character, because I still feel that they've not quite found where she is yet. But like we've said, look at most of them, and that's pretty much the case for all of them. The first season is a little different. Sometimes maybe a little better in John Pertwee's case, but by and large, first season, and William Hartnell's case, to be fair, as well. But yeah, I thought it was fairly strong, but not really, really strong. But it was fresh, and I like that.
Cool. Okay. So 7.9 out of 10.
Yes.
Okay. As alluded to at the beginning of the show, a little bit of information for you, Scarf related. Philip Bates of the Doctor Who Companion tells me that the Doctor Who Season 18 Burgundy Scarf is soon to be available in a new manageable size. It was first released in 2013 in Africa, and is set to be released at a more concise 195 centimetres. So this is the Season 18 Burgundy Scarf.
And just to follow on, the comment I was thinking of was not Blackadder, it was Father Ted.
Oh, right, okay. So
it was Father Ted, it was Father Jack's terrible candles. Pip Madeley's has put up a nice comparison of the crystals in this TARDIS to the ones in Dragonfire.
All right.
You know, the crystal cave where there's the map?
Yes.
The crystalline structures in there look very similar to the ones in
really?
The... Yeah, which is a nice, interesting comparison.
Yeah.
But there we go.
Yes. Yeah, so that is The Ghost Monument, which is quite a good title for a Doctor Who episode, actually. It's probably one of the best ones for a while, I think. We will be back next week. Tell us what you thought. Again, continue to tell us on Facebook, etc. Tweet us, email us, harass us on social media in whatever way you see fit, and we'll maybe come back to any interesting points in next week's podcast with a K. Until then, it's goodbye.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast, available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.